Great, we're gonna take on then, I believe that's item number seven, which is a presentation on California Sea Grant's Humboldt Bay Ocean Acidification and Eelgrass Project.
Great, thanks everybody, and I apologize for being a little late. Last minute, childcare thing came up.
You'll need to point it towards that black thing on the wall.
Yeah. Oh, the guy behind me is the controller. Okay. So this project is a collaboration between Sea Grant, Humboldt State University, and the funding is from the Ocean Protection Council. So it includes this list of folks. Jeff Abel is a chemical oceanographer. Frank Shaughnessy is a seagrass expert at Humboldt State. There's Tessa Hill at UC Davis. Terry Sawyer is at Hog Island Oyster Company, a co-owner, myself. I need to update that. Stephen Pullman was with the Weah Tribe. It's now Tim Nelson is their environmental project leader. And then there's James Ray with Wildlife. Kyle Weiss and Brian Tissot are also with Humboldt State, and there's Eric Bjorkstedt, who's with Humboldt State and NOAA. And there's the picture in the upper right shows some Ocean Protection Council staff, including the new director, Deborah Halberstadt, who helped us secure this funding, which is Prop 84 funds. And the reason why I'm here is that ocean acidification really is it's a water quality issue from the standpoint of carbon dioxide being a pollutant. And in contrast to climate change, which relies on models thinking about light absorption and re-radiation, the results, the problems with excess carbon dioxide in the atmosphere for ocean chemistry is really direct. It's something you can demonstrate on a tabletop. You can take a pH indicator and even exhale through a straw and into the water and bubble carbon dioxide in there, and you can see the pH change. And what's happening, I don't have a laser, is the carbon dioxide, as it dissolves into the water, changes into carbonic acid, basically. And so it lowers the pH of the water. But the real impact on marine organisms is that consumes and makes unavailable carbonate ions, which is most calcifying marine organisms. Use carbonate, calcium carbonate is what they build their shells with. So as carbonate becomes less available, it becomes harder and harder for them to build and maintain their shells and other hard calcified parts. Go. Okay. Is it? There we go. No. All right. And
you got to point it at that wall, actually.
Right. And so this is a listing of some of the types of organisms that are of concern that may be impacted by ocean acidification include coccolithophores, which are really tiny phytoplankton, little algae. But they can be really numerous. Actually, the White Cliffs of Dover are built of microscopic coccolithophore tests. Stony corals, everybody's kind of aware of the problems the Great Barrier Reef and other coral reefs around the world are facing. But in addition to temperatures, ocean acidification is making it hard for them to build skeletons. Around here, sea urchins are a significant fishery. Pteropods, which are these called sea butterflies sometimes, are little free-swimming snails, but they're really important food for salmon, among other things. So that's another area where pretty relevant and important for us. And then coral and algae are another another species or another group with calcified parts. But something that's really important for our region is oyster larvae. And it's pretty dramatic. This is some electron microscope images, and you can see that the top row is days 1 through 4 of a oyster larva developing in normal seawater conditions, and then the bottom row, you can see all the defects in the growth and the much smaller size attained by an oyster larva grow in acidified water. And that's kind of one of the major applied impacts, and they're already seeing problems with that up in existing hatcheries up in Oregon. Whiskey Creek is one up in Oregon. And we don't have any yet, except there are a few Hog Island oyster companies building a hatchery right now on the Samoa Peninsula, and Coast Seafoods is in permitting to create another. And that'll be really beneficial for the oyster aquaculture industry here. There's a concern about ocean acidification, impacting these new installations. And so here's a pretty clear graph of what's going on. A lot of you probably are familiar with the red curve, which is the atmospheric concentration of carbon dioxide since 1960, and that's from the Mauna Loa on Hawaii station, and you can see the little annual cycle squiggles, but the rapid trend upward, and this only goes to 2010, and now we're above 400 parts per million, when pre-industrial times was right around, the bottom of the graph, around 280. But marching in lockstep with that, since they've been taking the measurements, is the seawater concentration of CO2, which is in the blue curve. And about half of the excess carbon dioxide that's being emitted is being dissolved into the oceans. And the consequence of that, as I explained a little earlier, is this change in pH, and that's that downward green curve and that right-hand axis. Pre-industrial pH was around 8.2. And now we're around 8.1 or almost to 8.05. And remember, pH is a logarithmic curve. And so going from 8.2 to 8.1 represents about a 25% increase in the acidity, the concentration of hydrogen ions in seawater. And the really scary part is that if you plot that on a longer time scale, based on ice cores, you can look at the concentration of atmospheric concentration of CO2 in air trapped in ice cores in Greenland and Antarctica and places where they can find really old ice, and they've got data back to 800,000 years ago, which is that low, flatter part of the curve that tops, So basically, until now, the highest we've seen over the last almost million years was 300 parts per million, and we're now over 400, and the, high-end emission scenarios have us going well over 800, at which point the pH may drop another 0.4 units, which would be another 200%, which would be a twofold increase in acidity. So it's a really worrisome trend. And so this is kind of a zoom in on that figure. Important to keep in mind that minus 200,000, that's when humans became a species. So we've altered the chemistry of the atmosphere a great deal, far beyond anything that's been experienced by humanity. even more worrisome is that if you go back in geologic time, they're not as precise as going back to ice cores, but there are other less direct ways that we can get at what the chemistry of the atmosphere was like, and that's that bottom figure. And you can see that in the past, over the last, so there are records back hundreds of millions of years ago, and you can see that around 180 million years ago, atmospheric carbon dioxide was up at 4,000 parts per million, which is something that's discussed as, why is 400 parts per million a problem when in the past we've had really high, much higher, maybe tenfold higher atmospheric CO2. Well, the problem has to do with the feedback between the atmosphere and rocks, actually, which do a lot of buffering. Based on the atmospheric data and some other chemistry data from the geologic record, they're able to estimate mean surface pH of seawater. And you can see that even though from the bottom figure, the atmospheric concentration of CO2 has been much higher, you can see surface pH has been not nearly as low as you might expect, given how high the CO2 is. So CO2 has changed pretty radically, but pH has gone, as low as maybe 7.6 or maybe even 7.4, but the change has been over hundreds of millions of years. Over the past couple centuries, we've altered it 0.1 units, and may alter it as much as 0.4. Sort of, and if you look, past changes that have been that great have taken place over tens, 50s, hundreds of millions of years, and that's a real concern in terms of organisms can respond, can evolve over when change is gradual over hundreds of millions of years. When you're doing it in a couple hundred years, it's a big, it's a major difference. And even the changes that are seen there on that upper panel shows major sort of global cataclysms that are mass extinction events. Major perturbations of ocean chemistry that were associated with major extinction events, like that light blue KT is the Cretaceous Tertiary boundary, where there was the large asteroid that hit on the Yucatan Peninsula, and some of the other are the end Permian. And then there's the PETM, the Paleocene-Eocene Thermal Maximum was another one. And in many of those cases, there were major extinction events, especially in marine taxa. And the take-home from this paper is that the current rate of CO2 release basically is radically changing ocean chemistry. That may not have a parallel in the last 300 million years. So it's not just a million years more than the span of humanity, it's like 300 million years more than much of the geologic record as we know it. And I'll sort of skip to the punchline here. The reason for this is the change in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere raises increases the CO2 in the ocean, which lowers the pH. But because of the water cycle, when that occurs gradually, there's weathering of silica and carbonate in the rocks. And there's an enormous reservoir of that in the geology of all the continents. And you can sort of think of that like a giant antacid, but it's a slow-acting antacid. And when carbon dioxide increases over tens of millions of years, that antacid can act and increase what's called the alkalinity of the ocean, which is the ability to take up this excess carbon dioxide without major changes in pH. and major alterations to the availability of carbonate for those reef building organisms. But because we've done this so rapidly, the geosphere hasn't really had time. That 0.01, or sorry, 0.1 is a rate, and I think these are in, yeah, petagrams of carbon. So I think that's millions of tons, billions of tons. Anyway, big units. And it's much smaller than you see the fossil fuel emissions are 8.5, and land use changes are 1. So it's the amount we're kicking out versus the amount of buffering, the rate of buffering that the land can provide is large. So kicking a lot more out than can be dissolved really gradually. You know, in time, over thousands to millions of years, the buffering of the Earth will catch up with what we've done, but that's long past. We're going to see impacts on things that we all care about. And so there's good news, bad news here. The upwelling circulation off our coast makes our coast extremely productive. You can think of it sort of like when the north wind blows in the summers, we get upwelling of cold, deep water that is both rich in nutrients, but also has a lot of carbon dioxide. It's sort of an analogous to compost. So it's water that's sat and circulated along the seafloor, and all the material that's fallen down onto it has decomposed and released a lot of both nutrients, but also carbon dioxide. It's consumed oxygen, so it's low in oxygen, but high in nutrients, high in carbon dioxide, and that means that it's going to be more acidic. And this is actually the depth. So you can see that the color scale is the depth, and that's the depth of the it's where pH is about 7.75, so which is where one type of calcium carbonate goes from being easy to make to where it's actively dissolved. And so the shallower that horizon gets, it means that really acidic water is being brought up to our coast. And you can see that the upwelling does bring this acidified water up to our coast. And so that means that even though it makes it more productive, brings nutrients and makes our coast really productive, it also makes it sort of a hot spot for ocean acidification.
So, John, just, I mean, I guess, thank you. You know, at a pH, even 7.75, I mean, it's still above neutral. And so even staying on the alkaline side of neutral is enough to affect these changes that you're describing.
Yes, yes, and that's a really good point because, yeah, this man knows his chemistry. So yeah, I mean, you guys all know. 7.7 is neutral, but when you're looking at the solubility of different species of calcium carbonate, one is called calcite, another is aragonite, and in seawater, even a pH of 7.75 is right where we say the saturation state of aragonite is right around 1, which means it's neither light, doesn't have a tendency to dissolve or to calcify. But below that, where the below a pH of about 7.75, the saturation state will go below 1, meaning it's tends to dissolve. The oceans are naturally, well, pre-industrial times they're around 8.2, so even more basic. And so, yeah, ocean acidification means it's growing more acidic. It's still not past neutral. It's still slightly more basic than water with nothing else in it, but it's corrosive to calcified structures. And calcite is actually more resistant. Aragonite, which is one type, is more sensitive, so there are different pHs. And pH isn't the end-all and be-all of these measurements. That's sort of approximate. There are a lot of ions in seawater, and that's part of the reason why We went for this big fancy instrument because it can give you the actual true saturation state instead of having to approximate it based on generally around 7.75 pH is where the saturation state is won. This fancy instrument called a percolator can give you true saturation state, which there may be conditions where a slightly higher pH is still corrosive, or conversely, where a slightly lower pH is not. So having true measurements of the carbonate chemistry is how to really get exactly, basically what the organism's feeling, the relevant numbers in terms of what's hard on organisms or not. Another point I meant to make about this is that it means that our coast is going to see even lower pH values than sort of the global average, because we said the global average is right around 8.05, and we're already seeing conditions of sometimes during upwelling the pH off our coast may get down to 7.6. But because that upwelling is a process, it's been going on for a long time, organisms on our coast have some level of adaptation to deal with pretty low pH. The question is, of course, whether there's a breaking point. Are they adapted to some level of variation, but at what level is the pH get so low that even their capacity for adaptation is exceeded? Back to these fancy high-end instruments. The ocean chemistry, this sort of gold standard, is called a percolator, named for Burke Hales. I did not list, but I should have. Is an oceanographer at Oregon State who invented this thing called a percolator. And it measures both the total inorganic carbon, which is the dissolved, measures PCO2, which is the partial pressure of carbon dioxide, but then it measures the total inorganic carbon, which includes, in addition to carbon dioxide, the bicarbonate and carbonate ions. So it gives you the total, and those numbers are what you really need to get at this saturation state for aragonite and calcite. Of those, really fancy high-end instruments, there are only three currently on the West Coast. One in Neatarts, Oregon, at this there might be a few more up in Washington now, but in our sort of stretch of the coast, the one to our north is 300 miles away up in Neatarts at the Whiskey Creek Hatchery. There's one in Tomales Bay, but that's not really an open coast instrument, and there's one way down at Carlsbad. Having an instrument in our neck of the woods will really improve the spatial coverage of that really important measurement. So one really encouraging thing about our bay is that this is based on Senkus data. You guys know what Senkus? No. Central and Northern California Ocean Observing System. They have some ocean water quality instruments, one of which is at Trinidad on the pier, and another one is at the Chevron Dock in Humboldt Bay. And the blue trace is Humboldt Bay, and the green trace is the open coast. And what you can see is that 2013 was a good illustration, but you can see that during upwelling periods, the pH on the open coast in the green curve can dip really far down, I guess, down even around 7.4. But if you look inside the bay, it really doesn't take those major excursions downward during the upwelling season. And that may be really a major benefit to the calcifying organisms, including the oysters in Humboldt Bay. And you can see that it basically generally stays above 7.8, that sort of 7.5 or 7.75 critical threshold that can be hard on organisms. And looking at it a little more specifically in time, it's kind of a blow up on a small window of time, you can see that when the pH at Trinidad dipped quite low in mid-April. It stayed slightly higher at high tide, but at low tide, it stayed even higher. And so that we think may be evidence for, and others have found, that, well, the working hypothesis of this project is that eelgrass may play an important role in some of this observed buffering in the bay. And as you all may or may not know, there's a lot of permitting issues with aquaculture and potential impacts on eelgrass. And it's interesting that they, you know, to some extent, right now, oyster mariculture folks sort of view eelgrass as something that they'd like to be permitted to have greater impact on. Right? They wish that people wouldn't worry so much about impact on eelgrass. But it may turn out that the eelgrass is sort of buttering their bread, especially now that they're developing hatcheries. It's not as important. Both even the seed, so there are three different stages of oysters that are produced. Larvae, which are the smallest and most susceptible. Seed, which take larvae and grow them up to a spat that can be then sort of grown to adults. But both the seed and then adult grow out are much less susceptible to low pH, but the larvae are especially vulnerable. And so now that the industry is developing hatcheries, they may be, changes in pH may be a lot more important to them, and that's why this, one of the co-owners, Terry Sawyer with Hog Island, is really keen to get this percolator instrument in his hatchery. Oh, and for reference, the folks at Whiskey Creek have one, and they use it because they have to buffer their water. They have to add sodium carbonate to their water sometimes when the pH dips too low. They actually have to chemically buffer their water to protect the larvae in their hatchery. And they use the readings from their percolator to do that. And it's our hope that, and expectation, that probably won't be necessary in our bay yet. But it's, you know, it's important to know. And so that's, doesn't look like $65,000, does it?
That's how much does it pay?
But that's what it takes to build and install this puppy. And so, yeah, as I mentioned, it's really useful to hatcheries. But it'll give us an improved understanding of ocean chemistry. There are a few other hypotheses about things that may contribute to buffering in the bay. It may be phytoplankton, and it may also be resuspension and dissolution of carbonate sediments as water sweeps in and out of the mouth of the bay. This instrument will also be really helpful because right now there are oceanographers who have to send they take samples to get the really most accurate carbonate chemistry values. They have to send them down to Scripps in San Diego. But now they'll be able to go to this facility in the Samoa Peninsula and run bottle samples on their own. And it'll also facilitate research at Humboldt State has ocean acidification mesocosms, so tanks that can simulate lower pH. And they'll be able to really rigorously quantify the carbonate chemistry that they're producing inside those tanks. And it'll be really valuable experience for students as well. So there's where the hatchery is. I think it used to be Comet Street. It's now renamed Bivalve Way. the hatchery is coming right along. They got mostly the walls and everything up and are running plumbing and things. Marine Terminal 2 is where Coast is thinking about permitting a hatchery as well, and so the instrument that's at Hog Island is going to provide data that's pretty relevant for right at the same stretch of coast, only a kilometer or so away. And the data that's produced by this will be incorporated into Senkus, so publicly available in real time.
Is the eelgrass consuming CO2?
Yes, I failed to. Yeah, so the hypothesis is that, you know, it's a green plant, so it sucks up, it takes in carbon dioxide and incorporates that into sugars for growth. And, you know, in drawing down the CO2, that raises the pH. It sort of does the reverse of what we're doing by emitting excess CO2 in the atmosphere. And so we're planning to quantify how much of an ecosystem service is provided by this eelgrass by deploying instruments sort of parallel to the direction of flow, the tidal flow, and we'll quantify the chemistry sort of upstream of a eelgrass bed and then downstream, along with taking some velocity measurements, the velocity instrument, and then we'll be able to get sort of what the rate of carbon uptake by the eelgrass is. And we hope to also do this inside and outside of beds that have aquaculture going on, so to see what impact the aquaculture long lines have on this ecosystem service. And sort of a conceptual model of what we might expect to see if this is what the pH you might see across a mud flat in black, something you might see on an eelgrass bed would be the green trace, where during the daytime you see pH rise as it takes up lots of CO2. But at night, it's an organism, so it actually will respire. So in some cases, at night, it may bring the CO2 below lower pH, and excrete excess CO2. There's reason to believe, based on some recent work at Oregon State, that the most important condition is sort of the maximum saturation. So the idea being that the organisms, or at least oysters is what they looked at, may be able to make up for times when the pH is low. If there's fluctuations when the pH is good and high, they can bulk on, put on a lot of shell, and grow rapidly. When pH is high, even if that comes at the cost of some lowered pH. So with that, you know, with that in mind, even these fluctuations, even if there are dips in pH created by eelgrass, the mountains may more than make up for the hit you take at night. The last, and this is a pretty small component, but I think important, is we're going to start a bay-wide eelgrass monitoring program with Frank Shaughnessy and James Ray and Tim Nelson at the WEOP to look at, get a baseline of what eelgrass abundance and distribution is like in the bay, quantify some of the stressors, and build on some of the existing monitoring that's happened recently. And one of our goals, we're going to do it at a time of the year in June, after the eelgrass has sort of reached its a peak growth stage, but hasn't been fouled by a lot of algae and diatoms, which will make it good for ground truthing, aerial and unmanned aerial vehicle, like drone overflights. And we've got, as part of this two-year project, we've got we'll build this baseline. And then we'll continue this monitoring afterward, but at a reduced level, sort of going back to sampling a core set of sites every year, but then sort of on a rotating basis at a lot of other sites. And that's basically the gist of what we're planning.
Jim, thank you very much. Yesterday on the way up, I was listening to a radio program about the proposed expansion of some of the aquaculture in the bay. It was pretty interesting. It talked about some aspects of this. Wonder, does the monitoring that you're doing, is that in companion to or complementary to or independent of that project? Is it, do they mitigate and require them to feed into a program like what you're trying to solve here?
I would say they're sort of complementary, and we're definitely thinking about how we can make what we do compatible for purposes of comparison with what's being done. You know, Coast will have to do some monitoring as part of their permit for expansion. But this funding is more, especially for the eelgrass monitoring component, I think is intended as a sort of aquaculture independent.
Right.
But it certainly behooves everybody to make sure that the measurements we take are comparable, because then it'll be a lot, both sets of data will be more useful when they can be compared.
Yeah, super interesting.
Yeah, thanks. Thank you, Joe. Very in-depth and informative. I guess one of the couple of takeaways I got from your presentation, first one, is that our water quality concerns are being driven by air quality degradation, right? So it's like, we just try and address the water quality, it's only half of the puzzle. But what I really think, an underlying message, you know, for those skeptics, all 17 of them, that don't believe in climate change, I think what you've done, though, is you've talked about atmospheric change in a way that maybe more people can understand, because you're talking about air pollution and how air pollution is affecting water quality, and you're just looking at one component of air pollution, that's CO2, and you've got good numbers to show that CO2 is risen. And you don't have to get into all this other extraneous computations, but it's a straight line showing how CO2 concentrations have increased. You can talk about air pollution because people can see it in the form of smog, and how that is, and then you have quantifiable information that shows how there's a direct relationship between increases in CO2 and affecting water quality, water pH. There's you're an extension, like I'm an extension. That's a great story. You know, you can package it in such a way that tells a good story to people that might, you know, glaze over looking at the numbers. So there's more to this, you know, in the way you present it. I appreciate it, and it's good work. Thanks.
Thank you. And I mean, that's a really good point. People, scientists who are working on climate change and ocean acidification, you know, this is called the other CO2 problem, and it is in many ways sort of more direct. And you know, climate deniers focus on uncertainty with models, but you can't, like, this is hard to refute. While you bring it up, so CO2 is the major driver of ocean acidification, but it can be exacerbated by other pollutants like sulfur dioxide, you know, acid rain, and nitrates, which makes nitric acid. And a lot of these other atmospheric pollutants can exacerbate ocean acidification, as can biological oxygen demand. You shunt a bunch of carbon-rich effluent you guys know about this. I mean, you dump a bunch of carbon-rich sewage or something into the near shore, and that is going to lower the pH even further. So there are stormwater too. I mean, so all these things, there are local management things that can be done to at least not exacerbate the sort of large picture ocean acidification that's ongoing.
Why don't I have any speaker cards? Any other questions, comments? Joe, thank you so much for coming.
No, thank you. Thank you
very much. Appreciate it. All right, we're going to move on to our last agenda.